8:15, having arrived, the Education Finance Committee will be called to order. And I'm looking around to see who looks the most attentive this morning. Representative Myra. We have minutes to pass here from March 6th. Would you care to move those minutes? I expect you've read those thoroughly.
Yes, I have.
Very good. Representative Myra moves approval of the March 6, 2014 minutes. Any discussion on that? If not, I'll call for the vote on that. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion carries. Representative Newton.
Yes.
You are up first on House File 1917. And Mr. Strom, should we have him give a little background on his bill? And then do you want to go over the... Did you have some spreadsheets on this one? So I think what we'll do is, Representative Newton, would you like to move your House File 1917 for possible inclusion?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 1917.
All right, that's on the table. And what I'd like you to do is, if you would talk about your bill, we'll have your testifiers, and then when we get to discussion, Mr. Strom has some information that could be passed out that will inform the committee on how much every school currently gets and so forth. So, Representative Newton, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1917 increases the maximum safe school levy for school districts by $20 per pupil unit and increases the same levy for intermediate school districts by $10 per pupil unit. You can see on the House Research Bill Summary the various activities that are covered by this. But the important thing is we're talking about school safety and having the funds in our schools to make sure that our buildings are secure. I recently visited Adams School in my district and had to go through the system of showing my driver's license, running it through a system, having someone in the principal's office open the door and that sort of thing. So we've really increased the security in our schools, but there remains more to be done, and we need to ensure that we provide the districts with the sufficient funding to do that. With me today, Mr. Chair, I have several people who would like to testify. Chuck Holden is our facilities director for Anoka Hennepin School District, and so I'd like to turn it over to Chuck.
Very good. Mr. Holden, welcome to the committee. If you'd please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck Holden, Chief Operations Officer for Anoka Hennepin Schools. Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm here as Representative Newton explained to talk about our new security system in Anoka Hennepin Schools. And how we feel that safe school levy authority, additional safe school levy authority, would benefit our students and parents and staff. How we view student safety in Anoka Hennepin and all over this country actually has been radically changed in recent years. You're all aware of that, but never as dramatically as last or December of 2012 with Sandy Hook, Connecticut, Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. After that event, our district spent months talking to our parents, our staff, some of the fears our students had, law enforcement agencies about how we could make our schools safer. Many of the things they had done in Connecticut, we do in Anoka Hennepin. Lockdown drills, training, crisis plan, sharing with our law enforcement agencies. But we knew that we were vulnerable in perimeter security. All the studies that we have read and talking to Homeland Security, the FBI, and local law enforcement indicated that perimeter security is a great deterrent to making schools more of a hard target versus a soft target in their terminology. All of these things that in schools are fairly new to us, but our understanding is if someone is intent on doing harm, they're more likely to go to a location where they have easier access. So in effect, we undertook a project to move our clipboard, our voluntary sign-in for parents and visitors to schools, from the principal's office on a kind of a voluntary basis to a mandatory system, which is very similar to how you would check into an apartment building, get into a vestibule and need to be buzzed in. We talked to our school board about dedicating $1.2 million in capital improvement money our Safe School levy money is used for police liaison officers and other projects. So we dedicated capital improvement money for this effort. Last summer installed these new vestibules and protective entryways to our school, including a film on our glass, a glass treatment, card swipe check-in systems, remote cameras. As Representative Newton indicated, when you come into our school now, you're stopped in the vestibule, and you'll talk to a school staff member, a secretary, and have to present your driver's license, and that you'll get a badge printed, and then they'll allow you entrance into the school. The intent of that is not to restrict access, but to delay access until we know who's coming into our buildings and prevent visitors who could potentially walk into a building and walk directly down the hall into classrooms or a gymnasium, prevent them from doing that. In addition, before and after day school or daycare parents used to have come to a building with doors unlocked at 6:30 in the morning. We've locked those doors, installed proximity readers in those doors, and every parent that registers their child in before and after school daycare is issued a key fob, and which is a proximity reader, a little piece of plastic. They walk up to the door, and they're allowed entrance into the school. The average cost per school for the upgrades that we've made is just under $45,000. We installed these units in 27 buildings last summer. Our parents and staff, our school board, after the first sticker shock, a couple of weeks of getting used to the system and getting a driver's license out when they approach the school, are very appreciative of it, and it moves actually quicker than when they used to come in and sign in on clipboards. So it's a smooth system, it works well, and I think overall our parents still feel very welcome coming to our schools, which was important to us, not to make our schools into something that were frightening and obstructive to get into, but they feel a little more secure, and our students really don't recognize the change. These projects are very important to us in providing a safe learning and environment for our students, and we're expanding that to our secondary schools this coming summer. We've just talked to our school board about an additional $1 million in capital project money to move this to our middle schools and high schools for next year. So with that, any financial help with these types of security projects would be appreciated. It is an impact on our capital improvement budget. So with that, any questions?
Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Holden. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Do you set a priority list in your school district whereby you decide what has the greatest importance to the safety of our children, and then set your improvements based on that?
Mr. Holden.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, we do. We prioritize safety as our overall goal, and move projects from our capital facility improvement budget to a lower priority. Office remodels, replacing ceiling tiles, carpeting, have moved down to make room for these improvements for safety.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
This question is for Representative Newton. What kind of property tax increase would this cause in your area? Do you know?
Well, the Representative Newton, we're going to get to that.
Okay.
If, in fact, maybe this is the time to do it. So, Mr. Strom, if everyone should have this in their packet, and this will answer that question. We can deal with this at the same time. So, if it's all right, Representative Newton, can we? All right,
please,
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, very briefly, there's an estimated Safe Schools levy printout in your packet. What this tries to show is the amount of the existing levy in the first column, or the second column, rather, after the pupil count. And then the last four columns show the impact if all districts were to levy at the max under this bill. And you can see that the additional $20 per district in the fourth from the right-hand column If all districts were to levy, the max would be an additional $16.8 million in local property taxes. The third from the last column shows the $10 increase for those districts that are members of intermediate school districts, which is $2.5 million. And the second to last column then shows a $19.4 million levy increase as the maximum levy increase, or $21 per pupil. And the printout is organized as in previous years. If you go down to district number 11, the Anoka School District, you can see that their increase would be about $796,000 should the district choose to use the full authority of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Strom, would intermediate districts then benefit from both of these increases?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, the column labeled intermediate increase, you can see for those districts that are members of intermediate school districts, they would get that additional $10 of authority per pupil of their member district. So they would benefit from that part of it.
Very good. Representative Newton, do you have other testifiers?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe we do.
Mr. Holden, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you would please state your name.
Yes, my name is Sandra Lewandowski. I'm the superintendent of Intermediate School District 287.
Very good.
Good morning. I'm representing actually all three of the intermediate school districts in Minnesota in support of increasing the Safe Schools levy for both regular school districts and intermediates. All three of the intermediate districts provide extensive programming for the highest need students in Minnesota. The students that come through our doors come with complex special education disabilities and extraordinary mental health needs. Such combinations of disabilities can often result in aggressive and dangerous behavior. With growing concerns about safety in my own district last spring, I wrote to Governor Dayton, telling him that I was unable to ensure that I could keep everyone in my school district safe. As a result, we also met this past summer for a full day with the Department of Education, the Department of Public Safety, and the Department of Health and Human Services to articulate the growing challenges in meeting the needs of over 1,000 full-time students who are served through the intermediate districts. These services that we provide have become the first line of defense for the children's mental health system in our state. We learned from the three commissioners that the Olmstead ruling that currently is unfolding will continue to send students with the very highest needs back to community settings. And when these students come back to a community setting, they need a program, an educational program, much different than the schools and programs that our current schools provide. In light of this growing change, I'm especially concerned that the intermediates were the only school district that was not approved for an increase last year in the Safe Schools levy. And in fact, due to the change in weighting formulas, we actually lost Safe Schools revenue as the bill that you passed last year. I'm asking that the legislature recognize the magnitude of needs that public schools are responsible for. We're in a position of trying to meet the very high level of special education needs of such students while ensuring the safety of staff to work in our school environments. To best understand these responsibilities, one must first understand the children. In my district, we serve over 650 full-time special education students and 400 of the highest risk area learning center students in Hennepin County. It's often hard to comprehend what these needs look like to those not familiar with intermediate programming. I want to very briefly describe the sector of your public school system. Among my students, I have kids who assault our staff every single day and kids who are also assaulted regularly in their homes and communities. I have kids who have been sexually abused and kids who are the perpetrators of those sexual assaults. I have kids who threaten to commit suicide during the school day and those who threaten to kill my staff. Many of these students do have access to weapons. I have kids in our program who hear voices, and those who have psychotic breaks, and those who have no conscience. I have kindergarten students whose behavior is so aggressive and disruptive, they're placed in one of our programs at 5 years old. I have adolescents who are homeless and mentally ill, and whose only safe place to land is in our schools. They threaten and curse our staff, and yet they count on those same staff to provide the only safe place they have. In the past year, I've had a student who returned to school after using a knife to stab a female in the neck at his group home, and I have dealt with a 14-year-old suicidal female student who was involved in sex trafficking. I have students who threaten to blow up my schools, and I lay awake some nights wondering which one might actually act on those threats. I have significant gang involvement in several of my schools and often need police to quell the fights that occur as a result of those warring gang members. I've had several police cars arrive to break up a fight at the same time as an ambulance arrived to transport a pregnant teen mom who was going into labor. I have students who have been in jail and students who will at some point serve life sentences for the crimes they will commit, and these will be crimes of rape and murder. Most recently, in February, I had some of our elementary students provide Valentines to our school board to recognize School Board Recognition Week. And then one of those same students returned to her classroom and assaulted a teacher, giving her a concussion that resulted in her staying out of work for several days. We later learned that that student had just had her father sent to prison. I have a student who knocked a staff member unconscious and a student who has sexually assaulted a female teacher in my classroom. I've had staff with broken noses and broken jaws, and the students who cause these injuries remain in my school because they have considerable special education protections and we owe them the right to an appropriate education. I regularly transport students to the hospital via 911 because they're having an acute mental health crisis. Rarely are they admitted to the hospital, and often they are back in my school the next day. I have two police departments that require we purchase two officers to place in our schools because they don't feel safe with just one officer in one facility. In one of the programs, we have two officers for 80 students, and I will assure you that they will maintain that they need those two officers and the significant costs that come with the contract. Like I said earlier, I wrote to Governor Deaton last spring to say that I can no longer keep my staff safe. I'm testifying that same fact to you again today as I did last year. Following high-profile school shootings, we often hear the lament that surely someone could have seen the tragedy coming. I suggest to you I see a tragedy coming and that we have a collective opportunity to change that and do something about it by passing this bill that will allow for additional security measures to be taken. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this is your school system, and I submit to you and that you and the governor and I are responsible for keeping the sector of our schools safe, and I urge you to grant the increase asked for in this bill.
Superintendent Lewandowski, thank you so much. Representative Selzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Superintendent Lewandowski, for your strong testimony. And I just want to, before I ask my question, just compliment you on your very outstanding leadership. And I have enjoyed touring some of your schools, and your professional staff is unbelievable, even as they share the stories of some of the dangers they face. So thank you for your great service. And I just have a question about the amount, you know, the additional $10. The needs are great, and I'm wondering, where that figure came from. Is it based on a calculation of what it would take to make staff and students safer?
Superintendent Lewandowski.
Representative Marquardt and Representative Seltzer, thank you for the question. The current amount that we are allocated is $10, which our member districts, we asked them to turn the full $10 over to us. We have unmet needs that we have not been able to find the resources to allocate, and we felt that although this is a significant doubling of it, that the kinds of kids we were seeing could easily use up the additional $1 million that would come to School District 287. And we have a list of needs that we would work off of to try and implement should the bill be passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your testimony. And I can't even imagine what you go through on a day-to-day basis. And I appreciate you sharing the concerns and challenges that you face. And similar to Representative Seltzer's question, you present the challenges as an urgent need, and I had a question for, a couple questions. The first question was for Representative Newton, if maybe he could explain why the effective date is for the year 2015 and later, if it's such an urgent need.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Wills. You know, if you'd like to make an amendment to change, to move the effective date up, we could do that. But I believe it has to do with the finances and tax year.
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wills, the levy for taxes payable in 2015 is the next one that will be certified. The Pay 14 levy, which is revenue for fiscal year 15, was certified this past fall and is being collected this year. It's possible with some of our formulas to shift the money into the previous year, but generally speaking, we're always a year behind on the levy. We've got to go a full another year ahead on the levy in order to capture that revenue.
Representative Wiltz.
Thank you. So if I understand correctly, we would have to take from our reserves or from our surplus if we wanted to fund it earlier, potentially?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wills, or we can tell the districts to recognize that money early, in which case then they can spend it in that fiscal year. That's what we've done with some other programs on occasion. It's a bit of an accounting issue that's not in some ways appreciated, but sometimes that's the only way the money can go earlier when it's a levy source of the revenue.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate the explanation, and I had another question.
Very good. Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also, with our 24-hour rule, I don't think I could change this at this point, but maybe we could have that discussion later on. And my other question was, I'm looking at the spreadsheet here, and I don't see any explanation on what it would be an average tax increase per household, if there's any breakdown so we can kind of see more of the nuts and bolts on that.
Anything on that?
So maybe that would be for Mr. Strom.
Well, Mr. Strom, I mean, he's getting his computer working now, and probably a matter of, but while we wait on that, any further questions?
I think I'm good for now. Thank
okay,
you.
I'm going to take one more question, and then do you have other witnesses
or others who would like to testify? Briefly.
Okay, so we're going to take one more question, then we're going to hear the rest of the testifiers, and then lay this bill over. Yes, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I empathize with you as a former school board member, and in my school district, we finally had to put in an armed police officer at the high school because the principal at that time had said he wouldn't have his own children in our school district, and we're in a rural school district, so I know it's a difficult situation. But last year, I presented some information to the committee here about the negative effects of self-actualization, and I guess the one thing I'd share with you is that some of these curriculums like DARE, the QUEST program, and others that promote what's known as critical thinking and decision-making actually are promoting self-actualization and atheistic psychology to our children. The result is it actually makes the situation worse, not better. So I just encourage, I've got a packet to give you if you want that gives you specific examples of the curriculum. But the curriculum we're promoting into the schools, in many cases, because it's based on a faulty view of human nature, actually throws gasoline on the fire and makes the situation worse, not better. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. No response on that. All right. Superintendent Lewandowski, thank you so much and for your testimony and for your excellent work there. Next testifier, and then while he's coming up, Mr. Strom, have you got the answer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wills, on a $200,000 home, the increase, if all districts were to increase to the max, which would be a $19.4 million levy increase, would be about $6.20 on a $200,000 home for the year. And those would range depending on the value. It's an unequalized levy, so in a district like Minneapolis, for instance, that'd be about $3.75. In a district like South St. Paul, which is relatively property poor, it'd be about $14. And so on. The Anoka district, about $7.50. So, Mr. Chair, on a $200,000 home, that's the annual impact.
Very good. Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell from Schools for Equity and Education. I'll be very brief today. Representative Newton has come forward with, I think, a very important bill. I think Mr. Strom talks about the unequalized nature of it, but I think that we can work toward that. I think that there, as we talked last week with the facilities piece, the major facilities piece, I think these types of issues need to be addressed, whether they're facilities or staff. I think the safe schools are something that we all want. I was talking to a superintendent the other night from Iowa, and they have a lot greater commitment to many of these things than we do here in Minnesota, and I think it's a path we should also follow. So thank you very much. I'm a little frazzled. I got to head to the Senate, and there's only one of me. So
thank you very much. Thank you. Representative Newton, any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chair. I think we all see the importance of this.
Very quickly, Representative Bernardi.
Well, yes, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if this was equalized and was fair across the state how we paid for this, what would the equalization cost? I mean, you have different levels, but if we made it equal to something similar to it for equalization, do you know how much something like that would cost?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, the equalizing factors on our programs change a lot. If we were to use the average value as the equalizing factor, it probably cost in the neighborhood, this is just a rough guess, probably about a quarter of the total amount would come in local levy then, or in state aid, rather, if we were to use the average value statewide.
Okay, thank you.
So, Mr. Strom, you'd be talking around $5 million? Okay, thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who would care to testify for or against House File 1917? Very good. Thank you, Representative Newton. We will lay over House File 1917 for possible inclusion into the Education Finance Bill. Next up,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could just take a moment, we have some visitors here in the audience. Representative Myra and I would like to welcome visitors from the Burnsville 191 School District government students who are coming down to the Capitol today to learn a little bit about how things work. So send a warm welcome to them.
Welcome. Very good. Welcome this morning. We're moving to House File 2299, Representative Ward. Okay. So, who would like to move House File 2299?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2299.
Representative Bernardi moves House File 2299. Representative Ward, welcome to the committee this morning, and please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Marquardt and committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. I've added a couple of bullets. Sorry. We have House File 2299 is legislation increasing the lease levy amount from $162 to $212, or $50 per pupil unit, for school districts to pay rent on leased facilities. It also increases the amount that a school district may levy for an intermediate school district for facilities from $46 to $65 per pupil, $19 increase. This legislation is very much needed because many school districts are facing challenges in securing the needed classroom space to offer full-day kindergarten and expand early childhood programming. The lease levy is one of only two revenue sources the intermediate school districts have to address facilities needs. The complexity of the students being enrolled at the intermediate school districts has increased significantly, resulting in a need for more specialized spaces, which include design elements often seen in hospital behavioral health settings. We've just heard a little bit about that. The lease levy is a cost-effective and efficient way for school districts to address this need, and I would like to introduce my testifiers to support House File 2299 and provide further information. Superintendent Peggy Flathman from Fridley Public Schools and Matt Hamer, Finance Director from Fridley Public Schools. After that, we have noted Connie Hayes, Superintendent from Northeast Metro Intermediate School District 916 is not able to be with us this morning, but John Christensen from Intermediate District 917 is to help answer our questions and concerns.
Thank you very much. Superintendent Blathman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As I said, I'm Peggy Blathman, Superintendent of Fridley Public Schools, and thank you for this opportunity to speak to you this morning on behalf of House File 2299. First of all, I would like to thank you and the governor and all of the legislatures last year for their excellent work in 2013 education and tax bills, which included funding for our all-day K, early learning, integration funding, enhanced referendum equalization, and local equity revenue. These are important initiatives that help to establish the educational funding system and close the opportunity and the achievement gap. But today we are here to speak to in support of proposed House File 2299, which seeks to increase the lease levy for a district up to but not to exceed $212. For Minnesota Public Schools to continue to prepare students for the world's best workforce and to also allow the world's best economy to be here in Minnesota, this change will be crucial to allow schools the necessary funding to continue to provide quality education to all of our students. For the Fridley Public Schools, we have used this lease levy up to 162 for the following reasons. Because of our full day K, which we have had in place for over 7 years, and increased enrollments, we expanded instructional spaces in both of our elementary schools. We leased instructional space for our post-high school transition program students with disabilities. We maintain and expand our adult basic education program, and we also lease golf and hockey facilities for our athletic and activities. And now, Director Hammer will continue to talk about how else we could use this money.
Thank you, Mr. Hammer. Welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning. My name is Matthew Hammer, Director of Finance for Fridley Public Schools. I appreciate this opportunity to be here this morning in support of House File 2299. As we look into the future, this increase of $60 per pupil unit would provide Fridley Schools an opportunity to add additional instructional space for our elementary buildings, where we're seeing increased enrollment, as well as expand and grow our early childhood programming by leasing additional space. Along with the increase, we would also like you to consider the expansion of building lease levy's allowable uses. Under current statute, building lease levy only addresses the need for limited facility expansion and leasing of space for instructional purposes, but does not address districts' need for facility renovations and the need to address mounting school safety and security issues required through building modifications for secure entry and alike. The school's facilities financing work group has recently completed the recommendations for expanding allowable uses of building lease levy to include the ability for districts to use lease levy for enhanced school safety and security, the ability to not just add space, but to remodel existing instructional spaces, and to make provisions that would allow funding for long-term facility maintenance needs. At Fridley Public Schools, we're very interested in all the recommendations put forth by the work group, as our facilities average nearly 50 years of age and are becoming increasingly challenging and costly to maintain. As we forecast our facility needs, it is evident that our district will face many challenges in our effort to maintain high-quality facilities for our students. Basic deferred maintenance needs, such as roof replacement and exterior tuck pointing, continue to eat up much of our district's available revenue for our facilities. Building modifications for safety and security are expensive, but needed. This also continues to put pressure on our facility budgets that keeps our facilities maintained, secure, and updated to meet the changing needs of our students. Authorizing the proposed increase for building lease levy in House File 2299 would be a great step forward for Minnesota school districts. I would also urge you to consider the recommendations brought forth by the facilities financing work group in their entirety, as their recommendations would go a long way for providing school districts increased access to equitable and sustainable financing for their facilities. I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Hammer. And before we take questions, I'd like to ask Mr. Strom to go over, members, you should have another spreadsheet here And so, Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, members, very briefly, this spreadsheet just shows the Pay 14 lease levy for school districts and then divides that by the pupil count. So in the far right column, you can see the building lease levy per pupil and see how that varies among school districts. The fiscal note makes an assumption about which districts might pursue additional authority, those that are close to the current cap. But the purpose of the printout is just to give you some background about where the lease levy is currently at.
Very good. Representative Quam, you're on the list for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, as appropriate today, my local district is voting on a, referendum to fund a, a new elementary school, somewhat propagated from the action as mentioned by the testifiers today of all-day kindergarten. And at times I wonder, this was totally foreseen and why it wasn't included in, some assistance included in the, the bill that we passed earlier. I am confused a little bit looking through the spreadsheet and understanding that, as, statute exists, the commissioner shall grant this if the district meets the following criteria. And number one is has experienced pupil enrollment growth in the preceding 5 years. And looking at this, I see a district that has been decreasing and is actually lost greater than 10% of their enrollment over the past decade, hasn't been seeing any increase, and they're showing as having some funds there. Testifiers again mentioned intermediate district. Well, I chaired Zumbro Education District for a period of time, and that was a cooperative of seven small school districts that did the same function as the intermediate school districts. They had the same issues, the same problems. They've got a, a facility outside of the regular school that has the safety issues. And I notice that glaringly the previous bill and this bill don't seem to reference those in greater Minnesota, just a few in the metro. And that if there's a children, or I mean if there are children that are impacted and there's a need, we ought not care what district they're in. We ought not care what the cooperative effort is called. If it's good, then it's good, and it should be including these other children. And I just wanted, the authors and the members of this committee to keep that in mind, why we're doing this, and that, if something is good and appropriate and fair and it's going to help the students, then let us make sure that it is aimed to help the students that need it and not just some of the students that need it. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Quam, last year this committee had the wisdom to put $1.2 million in for lease levy for kindergarten, but the Senate did not share that wisdom. And so we didn't have that in the final bill, but we did have that coming out of here. I don't know if there's any response. Do you have further testifiers, Representative Ward?
Looks like you've got another question here.
Oh, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam brings up a good point about it, assuring that facilities and programs are available statewide, but I'd point him to the existing statute, 2.24 and beyond, that allows school districts across the state to petition the commissioner for the use of these funds. And then there are criteria, the first one you identified, but you failed to move on to read further, and it includes the purpose of the increased levy is the long-term public interest. And I would presume that providing facilities for a cooperative would be seen as in the long-term public interest and would then be eligible for this. So that's not to this legislation, because that's existing statute and the tools are available. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would Mr. Strom be able to explain to us the fiscal note, especially the assumptions? We have that handout in our packets, or maybe Ms. Johnson?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, the Department of Education, when they make a fiscal note about how a raise in a cap is going to affect districts, makes a guess. The basis of their guess was that those districts that aren't close to the cap are not likely to benefit in the short term, for which the fiscal note is specified by the higher cap. So as a result of their assumptions, they looked at how close to the cap districts were and decided that only two of the districts that were members of intermediate districts would immediately levy a total of $50,000 if this authority were passed, and that a half dozen school districts would also benefit immediately from the increase in the cap. I'm not sure of exactly what principle they used to arrive at that result, but essentially they're guessing at future behavior. If the testimony from to the committee today suggests there are other districts that would benefit from this authority and may take advantage of it sooner as well. But for these purposes, the department, when they put a fiscal note together, makes an educated guess about what behavioral change will happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Ward, do you have further testifiers?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, this is John Christensen, Intermediate District 917.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Christensen, Superintendent of Intermediate District 917, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House File 2299. Many of the comments that I were going to make have already been reviewed prior to this in the other testimony and the questions, but just a couple of quick points that I would like to make. The intermediate school district's ability to add classrooms, modify classrooms, reconstruct classrooms comes primarily from our lease levy and our health and safety levies. And we are finding that we are now more in need of modifying, customizing our various classrooms and adding classrooms. In fact, in 917, we are have a waiting list for some of our students simply because we don't have the space right now, and we're looking for ways to add that space to our needs. We are here today before you to ask for an increase in that cap because we see the intensity of need of students coming now, and it takes a while to get facilities ready for those needs. It doesn't happen in a short period of time, and so we're needing to have a revenue source that we can count on and that we can use then to add to the needs of our member districts. So we really appreciate your consideration of increasing the levy authority for the intermediates, and we're not here to the exclusion of co-ops or ed districts. If those opportunities for them could be done in a similar way in the future, I think that's another consideration that would be beneficial to the needs of the students in our state. So thank you for your time, and I'd answer any questions you might have.
Very good. Seeing no questions, thank you so much. Representative Ward, do you have further testifiers?
No, that's the end of the testimony.
Okay, all right. And so is there anyone here in the audience who would like to testify for or against House File 2299? All right, seeing none, any questions for Representative Ward? Representative Ward, any final comments?
I just want to thank you for listening to this again and encourage the committee to move this forward. It was needed last year, and you did the right thing, and we'll hope that we can move it ahead this year.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Representative Ward. I'll move House File 2299 be laid over for possible inclusion into the Education Finance Bill.
Thank you.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick question as we're going through these bills. Is the committee expecting to get new budget targets and new targets for levy targets as well? Or is this just we're just talking about these and then we'll see if we get those targets? Do you know where we are on those?
Very good. Representative Woodard, we are expecting targets and levy targets also. We do not have those yet.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Is there any idea of when we might get those?
Representative Woodard, I would say within the next day or so.
Okay, thank you.
I think that's the plan, where it will we will be able to do that. So I know last week the resolution, budget resolution, was set, I think, in the spending area it was like $527 million. Now, I don't know what will be one-time funding, what will become that, but I think in the next day or two we'll know. So thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, just to follow up to that, I just encourage the committee to remember that when we approve these levies that are not voter approved, it's falling on the taxpayers who are and citizens and parents who are experiencing the same devaluation in their dollar, purchasing dollar, and increased cost is what the school districts are. So I think there needs to be careful consideration before we put additional burdens on those families and businesses. Thank you, Mr.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And I have full confidence that our local leaders in our school, our school boards and superintendents certainly take that into consideration. Next bill on the agenda is House File 2648, Representative Keel. And who would like to move House File 2648?
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 2648.
Representative Woodard moves House File 2648. Representative Keel, welcome to the committee this morning. I see you brought some heavy hitters.
That's right.
I have to say, for full disclosure here, I'm going to be influenced on this one. I just want to be up front. There might be a conflict of interest. Mr. Brewer there was a superintendent at Dilworth Glendon Felton, where I teach, and Mr. Superintendent Jensen, student taught at Dilworth Glendon Felton, now is the superintendent in Hawley. So Representative Keel really knows how to put the pressure on the chair this morning.
Mr. Chair? So,
yes, Representative Dabney.
They may have had their ties to your district, but were they ever wrestling coaches? Isn't that the real question?
Well, that
isn't that the real pressure?
Very, very important, yes. Yes.
Mr. Chair, if you need to recuse yourself, I would be happy to be the chair.
Yes, very good. I appreciate all the good advice this morning. Representative Keel, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt and members. I have with me, as you know, District Superintendent Randy Brewer is from Winnemac in my district, and Superintendent Jensen is from Hawley. And we have a little bit of an issue with health and safety dollars, and would like to use them. EPA is requiring that their generators be updated, and they would like to use health and safety dollars to do the repairs. But since these gentlemen made such a long trip down, and I very much appreciate that, I will let them explain what they would like to do.
So, and who would like the Superintendent Brewer?
You're gonna thank you.
Go first. Thank
Chairman
you.
Marquardt and members of the committee, I appreciate your time this morning. It's still cold up north, believe me. We're up by north of Highway 2, and it's still a little bit cooler, so we enjoy the weather down here. Thank you for allowing us time to ask you to support this bill. I have a list of right around 10 northern schools, all the way from Clearbrook, Bagley, War Road, East Grand Forks, Sacred Heart, Norman County East, Hawley, Ogilvie, Kellyer, and there's many other schools that in the state who may or may not be aware of this ruling, who will have to make some upgrades to their generators to meet the new EPA environmental regulations by May of this year. The rule requires us to install emission controls on generator engines, which cost between $20,000 and maybe $75,000. Our impact in Winnemac is going to be right around $57,000. Hawley's is probably going to be closer to $75,000. Our school is, I should say, our enrollment is right around 450 students, where the school was built in 1998. So we had an older, a pre-2006 generator. It's kind of the way the ruling's talking. It's been noted by our electric provider that there are no reasonable benefits to justify the significant expense of the new emission control system. And so I did not receive any notice from the EPA, but our Wild Rice Electric Company sent out the proposed rule to us. So I left it go for a short time until my service provider of the generator told me of the consequences if we don't do the upgrade. So, which he said which would double my electrical rates. So what we did was is we acted on this appropriately, because if we don't, it'll impact, you know, the money or the revenue available to teach kids, because it'll come out of the general fund. This bill would help school districts to fix the upgrades without impacting the necessary revenue used for teaching kids. The bill is similar to a health and safety allowance that we had back in the 1990s to remove our underground fuel storage tanks, which then was an environmental concern. This is a one-time fix, and I guess it's also similar to some of the buses that are coming out today that have to have their REIA installed. You know, this is probably a 2010 EPA ruling for generators engine, and this is also diesel engines to get these emission standards put in place. So, you know, we're asking for your support, and I believe this is a real good logical need for to go through health and safety. So we need your support, and I guess I thank you for listening.
Thank you, and I think we'll listen to Mr. Jensen and then take questions of either. So, Mr. Jensen,
thank
welcome
you,
to the committee.
Committee. Mr. Brewer kind of covered most of it. It's just the fact that this is, you know, we put these generators in place in the beginning to help the district save money. We're all on a ripple or control type of setup with them. And yet now, for us, we're pushing $75,000 to bring this into EPA standards. It does not increase the efficiency or anything like that with the generator. It's just it has to do with emissions controls and monitoring the emissions of the actual engine. Again, if we could use the health and safety dollars for this, it would be a big savings, and it's dollars that would be able to go back into the classrooms as opposed to having to be spent on the generator issue. So any questions?
Just a quick question. Does it matter what year these generators were purchased? Is there a certain year where you wouldn't have to do this, or is it all of them?
2006.
Okay, 2006. Okay.
And older, yeah.
Very good. Thank you.
Ours was installed, I believe, in 97 or 98.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And gentlemen, this is quite the dilemma, because this is EPA going through your electricity provider, and then they have to tell you of the consequences, correct? Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, yes. That's just a travesty that they have to be under the gun by a federal agency through the local utility provider. This is going from bad to worse when it comes to the demands that are being made on, you know, like a school district that has limited funds. And now you're being told by your provider that, well, if you don't do this, you're going to suffer. Mr. Chair, I hope we can figure out a way to do this, but again, this is going to be a property tax increase. Would either of you comment on what this might cost your local taxpayers?
Superintendent,
I know it's minimal, perhaps, but...
Superintendent Jensen?
Yes, Superintendent.
Well, I'm not sure. I haven't done any kind of calculations, but it would be very, very limited. You know, $75,000, I can't think what our tax base is right now, but it would be minimal. And it's a one-time cost.
Right. And Mr. Chair?
Representative Erickson.
And sir, is it divided in half so that you pay half of it now and half later, or is there no formula for that?
We would have to pay our provider up front.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm presuming that when you're referring to your provider, that these generators are in fact backup generators, and if so, and given the age of them, $70,000 seems like a lot of money to have to spend on making emission standard upgrades. How much do these generators cost in the first place?
Superintendent Jensen?
We're in the process right now of adding on to our facilities, and we have to put in an additional generator for our increased square footage. That generator is $426,000. That would include some switching equipment that needs to go with it. So they are very expensive.
Other Representative Van Zels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would feel much more comfortable about what's going on here if there could be some documentation, at least, from the Chicago Regional Office of the Environmental Protection Agency to its state partner, which is the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Not that I am calling into question anybody's ideas here, but usually when the EPA promulgates a rule, it communicates with its partners in the 50 states, and then it's the responsibility of the PCAs in the country to communicate to those in the community that are affected by the proposed, or in this place, promulgated rule. So I support the bill, but going forward, I sure would encourage us, Mr. Chair, to discuss this with the PCA and at least get some verification that this is, in fact, required.
Any other questions of the gentleman here testifying? If not, Representative Keogh, do you have any other testifiers?
I think no, but I think that is a very good suggestion. I will see what we can do and check on that. But in the meantime, I think our small schools are really struggling with being able to keep up with rules, and it is an important thing for them to be able to do.
So. Superintendent Brewer, Superintendent Jensen, thank you so much for being here. Good to see you.
Thank you, members.
Is there any other public testimony for or against House File 2299? Any other comments? Representative Keel, anything else?
Nope, I think that is all. I thank you very much for your time, and we'll do some checking.
Okay, and I will lay over House File 2648 for possible inclusion into the finance bill. So thank you all.
Thank you.
Representative Reinert. Yeah. Representative, would you like to move your bill, House File 2696?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move House File 2696.
Very good. And we also, when we get into this, we have a spreadsheet and a run on this one, too. But we'll hear from your testifiers and go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill increases the appropriation for equity and telecommunications access by $6 million beginning in fiscal year 2015. This is an issue that touches all of us throughout the state. We are all acutely aware of the transformation in usage of and need for broadband telecommunications access for all Minnesota schools. The number of electronic devices that are present on our school campuses has mushroomed over the last decade. Tablets in various forms have been issued to all students in middle and high schools for classroom use, as well as into some of our high schools, but all students in some high schools, as well as research and assignments. More and more core educational functions are now delivered online. With the current funding cap at $3,750,000, the proration currently received meets less than half the known need. The broad recognition of this gap is affirmed in the annual report of the Governor's Task Force on Broadband, where this funding proposal is included among the group's legislative recommendations. We have with us today two testifiers directly connected to the issues and concerns addressed by this appropriation. And I'll let them introduce themselves and testify. I don't know which of you would like to go first. So,
good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Mary Messicomer. I am a technology integration development and outreach facilitator at TIES, which is a school district cooperative owned and operated by 48 member districts here in St. Paul.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you this morning. I am Mark Johnson. I'm the executive director
of the East Central Minnesota Educational Cable Cooperative. We call it ECMEC because it's easier to say. We are also one of Minnesota's telecommunications cooperatives, or clusters as it's referred to in this legislation, serving and owned by 14 member districts.
We are requesting an increase in of $6 million to the Telecommunications Internet Access Equity Aid, which is a state program that helps school districts pay the cost of internet access after they have tapped the federal E-rate telecommunications discount program. Currently, Minnesota school districts receive approximately $22 to $25 million from the federal E-rate program to sustain levels of broadband connectivity necessary to deliver education opportunities to students and also to run their operations. The Telecommunications Access Equity Aid program then makes up the difference for the portion that is not covered by the federal E-rate program. Currently, the Telecommunications Internet Access Equity program is funded at $3.75 million. This means that when that funding is delivered to us by the Minnesota Department of Education, it is prorated currently at about 43%. So it's not covering all of the cost after E-rate. The reason this program is particularly important to school districts is because there are a lot of other costs of maintaining technology infrastructure. And this program helps to cover the cost of that internet access, which can range, which ranges across the board in terms of cost to the of the connection to the school district door, depending on where you're located and your distance from your provider. This then, getting funding from, some help from the state on this, then frees resources for the school district to support the local infrastructure, such as the tablets, computers, and other technology that is being put into the districts. Schools use broadband connectivity these days for a wide variety of purposes. We deliver a lot of college career readiness opportunities to students. Using online learning, distance learning. We have content providers here in the state that provide opportunities for students in greater Minnesota to visit places like the Minnesota Zoo, Minnesota Historical Society, for educational opportunities that they would not normally have if we had to put them on a bus and transport them to those facilities. We also are under demand to increasingly do online testing in our schools for the state MCAs and other testing, standards-based testing. And in addition to all of that, we just really believe that we open up the doors of our communities to students when we have access, sufficient access to broadband capacity, to give them access to online learning resources and things outside of their local community. Mark, do you have anything you would like to add?
Sure, thank you, Mary. Our cooperative is in just north of the Twin Cities area in East Central Minnesota. We're one of those areas in the state that's quite underserved in terms of broadband access, which is kind of another issue, but it's the same thing, because we as a school then have difficulty finding providers who can provide us with the adequate bandwidth that we need. We work as a cooperative then to build a network utilizing the E-rate funding and the telecommunications equity access aid to build a network and to find a provider that can provide us with the same rich access that some other districts might have. So it's very beneficial for us to be able to do that. It's also very beneficial for us to work cooperatively to do this, because that lowers the cost. Individual districts aren't out trying to buy this bandwidth themselves. So we do that as a cooperative. And a quick story, I was a technology director in a district that, when I arrived in that district, they were what we would call bandwidth poor. They did not have adequate access at the time. And the talk around the district, when you talk with the curriculum folks and the teachers and everybody there, it was about what we can't do because we don't have enough access. We can't do this because we don't have have what we need. That district became a member of a cooperative that did do this purchasing cooperatively, which had the benefit of the equity aid and the E-rate aid. And overnight, I mean, it really was almost overnight, our discussions and our technology planning became about all the things we could do, the things that you heard Representative Brainerd and Ms. Metz-Comer talk about. They were able to do these interactive video field trips. They were able to bring those experiences to their students. They were able to talk about some shared network services that we do as a cooperative, again, to lower their costs by putting educational software, equipment, and things like that at a central location. So it was a dramatic change and a great, I think, a great testimony to what can be done at a cooperative level and when you have the adequate bandwidth that you need. And another, I think, exciting thing that we're doing now on a statewide basis that addresses the issues of one-to-one and all of the things, the curriculum and rich resources that are available over the internet, is building digital curriculum for our schools, our Minnesota schools. Minnesota, you know, schools can purchase digital curriculum from publishing companies and so on, and it's very costly, very expensive, and not at all aligned necessarily with the Minnesota State Content Standards. What we have done now statewide is begun a process of building that curriculum ourselves, essentially from the ground up. Again, accessing all of the rich resources that are part of the internet, but laser focusing that on the Minnesota State Curriculum Standards, and bringing that to our schools where our students can utilize it because or when they do have adequate access to the network and to the internet.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. In your packets also there is some additional information that House Research and the fiscal staff has put together. Mr. Strom, did you wish to explain that, please?
Madam Chair, the printout that's in the packet is a good complement to the map that the testifiers brought us. It shows which cluster each of the school districts is in, shows the eligible rates that would be reimbursed in the second-to-last column, if not for the proration, and then in the last column shows the prorated amount of aid that each district currently gets under the Telecommunications Access Program.
Thank you. Representative Woodard, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this might be for Mr. Strom. One of the ideas behind this is that as schools are moving towards digital textbooks, this is a, you know, this is a concept that we want them to move towards, and this helps them get there. Is there, within this, there is no allocation to non-public schools under the textbook aid. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, perhaps the testifiers can speak to this. There is an opportunity for non-publics to participate in the Telecommunications Access Aid Program. There's just a few that are, and I'm not sure. The testifiers maybe could tell you why that's the case.
Thank you, Mr. Sharma.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Woodard and members of the committee, non-public schools are eligible to take part in the Telecommunications Internet Access Equity Aid Program. They have a separate formula that is applied to them. And it is based on a comparison between two factors. One is costs that they may have greater than $10 per pupil unit. The other is the cost, the per pupil unit allocation that goes to the public school in which they, the public school district in which they reside. And whichever is the lesser of those two amounts is the amount that they are eligible for telecommunications internet access equity aid. They are required to apply for the aid through the MDE on their own. They can submit their cost data after E-rate and be factored into the formula that way. There are very few non-public schools that take advantage of this program. I think part of the reason is because many of them are fairly small when it comes to enrollment size. A lot of them get internet access either donated or drastically discounted due to community organizations or parent or teacher organizations, that kind of thing. Otherwise, too, they're just so small that to take advantage of the super big high broadband capacity that we are that the regions are providing to the public school districts is probably just priced out of their capacity to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome, Mr. Johnson, who's a Princeton High School grad. Very excellent student, I must say, and went on to be very successful. But, Mr. Johnson, the E-rate is something that I have been thinking about over the years. Is there any chance it will change? I see that it has over the years, but isn't the federal government talking about a change in E-rate?
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Good to see you. There are some, and I'll let Ms. Messcomer maybe comment a little bit more about that. She's a little more in tune with E-rate.
Okay.
But yes, there are some potential changes. The reason that funding does fluctuate from year to year does have to do with the fact that it is based upon free and reduced lunch NSLP data.
Yes.
And so as that changes in a district, which happens from year to year, then that amount of funding also changes. But I'll let Mary comment about changes potentially.
Representative Erickson, members of the committee, I've worked with the E-rate program since 1998. I'm the ipso facto, if you will, state E-rate coordinator for Minnesota schools. Yes, the FCC is looking at some program changes for the E-rate program. Within the next year or two, they have issued what they call the notice for proposed rulemaking this last fall to get all kinds of feedback from people who use the program to see what they should do. There were over 300 questions asked about levels of funding, types of things that are eligible for E-rate, how the E-rate is calculated, which is currently based on a school district's free reduced price lunch percentage, and so on. One of the biggest factors I think that I've seen in the comments is we are now actually nationally tapping the capacity of the E-rate program to the maximum for the priority one service category, which is the internet access telecommunication services. So one of the big issues that is a question is whether they will be able to increase the amount of E-rate available to school districts, non-public schools, charter schools, and public libraries.
Excellent, Madam Chair. That was a really important piece we learned.
Thank you. Representative Myra.
Madam Chair, thank you. This question is for Ms. Messnomer, is that correct?
Messicomer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No problem.
Could you clarify the $3.75 million covers 63% of the current costs?
It covers that percentage of the current costs, Representative Myra, after the E-rate discounts are already applied for and taken off.
All right.
Or, I'm sorry, 43%.
43%.
43%.
All right. Madam Chair, Representative Breinert, I was wondering if it is 43%, 100% would be $8,720,000. And so if you could just elaborate why this bill is asking for $9,750,000.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Myra, if you notice the language in the not in our legislation, but already in the current statute, 1.15, any balance in the first year does not cancel, but is available in the second year. These are expenses that are continuing to rise, and if we just think of the discussion we've already had at the table. You know, we're on the edge of maybe even more than doubling current usage in so many areas that this will not even begin to meet the need. We're actually just trying to go a little bit above current usage, and we think that we'll see in a few years that that won't, you think that we'll see in a few years that that won't even be adequate. So I think that's where we're at, just a little above current need and probably not adequate for the future. And I'll let either of our testifiers speak to that.
Representative Myra, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we are seeing exponential increases in use of bandwidth in our school districts, everything from one-to-one initiatives where students are being given devices, bring your own device initiatives where students are permitted to bring tablets and smartphones and things for educational purposes, to the huge increase that we're seeing in online resources. Mr. Johnson referred to some of the digital curriculum pieces that are being developed in the state. And so we continue to see much more bandwidth growth in the last 2 to 3 years than I've seen in the entire time that I've worked in telecommunications with school districts over the last 15 years. Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify? Mr. Heller?
Madam Chair, while he's coming down, may I just ask a question?
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To what extent do we see, to the testifiers, to what extent do we see broadband expansion, like in our ECMAC area, Mr. Johnson? Because I know we have a task force in our area, and I think you're part of that. So what I hear from families is, but my child cannot at home. And you know, that's a real frustration, because if we expect the learning to continue as they're doing their homework or their assignment, they can't do it except in the school building. So to what extent will we see that change?
Thank you, Representative Erickson, Madam Chair, committee members. You're absolutely right. And I do work with the Central Regional Broadband Initiative, which is looking at that very issue, broadband in the home. We do struggle with that, right? We have great access within our schools. We want the students to be able to go home and be able to use that content. And right now, that is difficult for them in a lot of areas, especially the rural areas. So we are working, the schools are working together with the community, with our providers, and so on, to try to find solutions for that exact problem. One of the things it does for bandwidth in the schools is when we don't have that adequate access, or we can't expect all of our students to go home and have that access, we need to provide that when we talk about digital curriculum and some of that content and some of the information they get from internet resources. We have to find a way to provide that to them going home, which sometimes results in downloading a lot of content and putting it on a device or something like that. Or some accommodation similar to that, which again increases the bandwidth that we need in the school to bring that content in, get it to the students so that they can go out and do it. So it's absolutely a great point, very much a concern for us as well.
Mr. Heller?
Yeah, thank you, Chair, Policy and Policy Committee members for the opportunity to speak. I currently unofficially represent the twice exceptional print disabled. I'm speaking on House File 2696. As we move ahead to almost double funding, I have some specific questions, and hopefully, just because I'm here talking, somebody can ask the questions, because it seems like I'm not up here for a therapy session, I'm up here for the public, and it's up to the leadership, which are the gifted individuals. According to Minnesota statute, there's 5 elements of giftedness, and now that's in the twice exceptional is also in the gifted statute. Anyhow, this is a specific question regarding Access Aid program grants. The specific question is, are school districts exempt from statute 16E, which is about content accessibility, which is 508 and 2.8 WCAG? I'm not sure how this fits into the district technology plans, which is funded by Perkins money, kind of pushed by Perkins money. I'd like to know specifically how that relates to this increase, and that is, if that's embedded in their technology plans. Since universal design was first for special education, now it's for everybody. You'll find that in our Minnesota waiver of No Child Left Behind. The fact is that since broadband is I'm assuming broadband is probably in-house use, and I'm not sure where the state is wired. We have an agenda to wire the whole state with the internet. That may impact us as well. And for the public to know, there was an acquisition by CenturyLink when they bought ABC with the federal government, a handshake, that they would provide internet for homes for $9.99 a month. It's my understanding twice exceptional learners are gifted as well, are motivated to learn independently. I'd like to know how much this money perhaps can be utilized for these students they have full accessibility at home.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hiller. Can I ask our testifiers if they can answer?
If they'd like to, yeah.
I can speak on a limited basis, Madam Chair and members of the committee, to those issues. I do believe that the Telecommunications Internet Access Equity Aid goes entirely for the connectivity piece, as does E-Rate. It does not cover content. However, I do believe that many school districts, to my knowledge, do make provisions in their technology plan policies to ensure that students with special needs or exceptional needs have those needs addressed in the classroom, whether it be with the technology or whatever other classroom material they are using. I also do know that in past technology plan manuals put out by the Minnesota Department of Education, school districts are encouraged to check websites against ADA recommendations for accessibility for people with exceptional needs as well. I can't answer the question about whether they are required to comply with ADA. I do believe, though, as local units of government, that may be something that they are expected to address, but I'm not 100% sure on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll just add to that you know, I mentioned the digital curriculum project that we're working on statewide, and while that obviously is content that isn't funded by this, it's done because of the internet access that we have and because of the one-to-one devices and all of those things, and we have that money available in part because of the equity aid that's available. But in development of that curriculum, accessibility and meeting special needs and meeting all learners where they are is very, very much a part of the process that we use in developing that curriculum. So we are making every effort to make sure that it does comply and that it is, I mean, that's, we're in the job of doing that in the schools to make sure that it is accessible to all students.
Thank you. Mr. Hiller, question.
It's my understanding the word is encouraged, not required. And unless things are required, it's done being Minnesota nice. If we're going to spend this much money making stuff more accessible, don't we have an obligation to make sure that school districts, nonprofits, are compliant to Statute 16E? I do want to make note that the National Federation of the Blind is out there today. They're going to be talking about the OMSED plan. And currently, OMSED plan summary is going to be also set. The summary is going to be set at a reading level. There's a reason for that. It's not about just full accessibility, but it's about text difficulty as well. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Hiller. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak on the bill? Any further questions from our committee? Any last comments from the author?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to add this, that these were such excellent testifiers, and in the information they provided us, I've never heard such a good presentation on the E-rate and what goes with it. And Representative Brainerd, thank you for bringing these testifiers and for answering Mr. Heller's question. That was just very good.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. I would have to agree with you. Very good.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Erickson. I think this is a commonly held value to move forward at this access across the state. So I hope we'll continue to support this as it moves forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Brainerd. House File 2696 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
We are finis. We're adjourned.